This is Water Cooler Christianity, a podcast of the North Carolina Conference of the United Methodist Church, where we talk about how faith and pop culture intersect in our everyday lives. I am Laura Whitman, a pastor in the North Carolina Conference, and I'm joined by my co-host.
Hi, I'm Aaron Hayworth. I'm also a pastor in the North Carolina Conference.
And today we have with us a special guest, Patrick Murphy, who is one of the pastors at Front Street United Methodist in Burlington. Patrick, feel free to introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about you.
Awesome. Good morning, guys. My name's Patrick. Like Laura said, I am associate pastor for discipleship at Front Street Methodist in Burlington. I've been there almost about to start my fifth year there. And this is my second appointment, and my first one as an associate. So it's been a really interesting time being able to focus ministry more in specific areas like mission and discipleship.
Absolutely. Well, we're glad to have you with us. And we are going to start with a few questions.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Beautiful question. Number one, Describe your walk with God in two words.
Relentlessly pursued. I guess for me, I just think of how easy it is to fall into rhythms that can become rather stale. I think every minister struggles with seasons of dryness as well as seasons of richness. And it's important, I think it's been important for my relationship with God to feel that God's grace is constantly pursuing me. It seems that there's always something at any point in my walk where I've been in a dry season or a stale season where something has prodded me or pulled me back into the glory of God and the presence of Jesus. And that's something that I've always been grateful to have experienced. And I think not everybody knows it and realizes that they're loved unconditionally. And it's hard for them to realize that all the time, I think, just because of how complex life is. So relentlessly pursued.
Well put.
Absolutely. Well, assuming that you were stranded on a deserted island, and hopefully God pursues you there as well, but if you were stranded on a deserted island and had access to one television show that you could watch on repeat while you were there, or even perhaps a movie, what would that one thing be that you could watch while you're stranded on this island?
I feel like probably a lot of people would say The Office. But just to be different, I'll say Game of Thrones. Been watching that since it started in 2010. And it being on the final two episodes ever now, it's been something that's been consistent for me over the last couple of years. And surprisingly, I've never actually gone back and rewatched it because I figured I promised myself I would go back and do that after the show is completely over. So I'm looking forward to doing that at some point and reliving all the trauma of that show.
Yeah. Well, when you're on the desert island, you will have plenty of time.
Yeah.
You
rewatch
will.
It.
You yeah. will. It'll just be you and God and Game of Thrones. So, there you have it.
Final question that we want to ask you is, who is your favorite sinner?
Oh, that's a great question. Probably my wife, Brittany. And just the reason for that being, right now she's pregnant with our first child, and it's been a really amazing experience so far, preparing for new life. But it's we've been together for over a decade, over 12 years now, even though we've only been married for six. But just being able to be so into each other's lives and seeing all the ins and outs and nuance to each other has just privileged me with knowing her in ways that I don't know anybody else. And so because I know her so well and she knows me so well, I would have to say that she's my favorite sinner. So she'll probably appreciate me saying that too.
I'm sure she will. Well, one of our favorite things to do here at Water Cooler Christianity is to get a little nerdy. And so we're going to get nerdy today about one of Patrick's favorite topics, and that is Tolkien. So Patrick, would you like to tell us what it is about Tolkien and his writings that you love so much?
Yeah, I've been reading J.R.R. Tolkien since I was, I believe, in high school, so probably around ninth grade. So didn't start early, but it's been a long time ago now since ninth grade. But I think for me, I've always enjoyed literature that has a great sense of adventure about it. And fantasy is a medium through which great stories, I think, have been told throughout history. And for me, The Hobbit happened to fall into my lap at just an opportune time. And so I began to read it, and I read it in like 2 days, and I just couldn't put it down. It was just this amazing story, of course, about Bilbo Baggins. And that led me to looking into other things that Tolkien wrote, like, you know, The Lord of the Rings. Those movies were coming out about that time. And so I was getting into those as well, and trying to sort through what the movies did versus what the books do. And it was a good time. I found myself becoming a little bit snobby when it came to literature. This is the time that Harry Potter was kind of exploding too. And so I was like, oh, I don't read Harry Potter, I read Tolkien, you know? So I had this kind of
real serious business.
Yeah, real serious business.
So. Well, I mean, when you think about it, you said your Desert Island TV show, Game of Thrones.
Right.
This is something that probably wouldn't exist, at least in the form that it's in, without the work of J.R.R. Tolkien.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of great fantasy writers, R.A. Salvatore, George R.R. Martin, that that I think probably owe a lot to people like Tolkien and Lewis and other famous fantasy writers.
Mm-hmm. We want to begin a little bit with the life of J.R.R. Tolkien. And so tell us, what is it about Tolkien's life and experiences that compels you?
Yeah. So from an early age, Tolkien was someone who experienced a lot of trauma. He was born in South Africa, what's now South Africa, in 1892. And his family moved back to England when he was just 3 years old. His father died around that time, and he was raised primarily by his mother until about the age of 10. She died of diabetic ketoacidosis, for which there wasn't treatments then. It was only about, I think, a decade later when they developed treatments for that, and that could have saved her life. So she had an untimely death. And so from an early age, he had these traumatic experiences of loss that I think contributed a lot to how he moved in his relationships, and how he valued relationships, and how he strove for friendships in his life. He was also formed in the Christian faith from an early age. He was primarily raised in a Catholic commune following his parents' deaths. And so I think in his life, in some ways I see similarities to maybe like John and Charles Wesley, in that his mother was a very key influence on his life from an early age, and stressing the importance of Christian faith to him from an early age. And so that was always a center point for his life, was his faith. And that vocation was impressed upon him early on. He also, he was a soldier in World War I, and in those experiences, he, again, experienced a lot of loss through friends that had followed him into the military. He was involved in the Battle of the Somme, which is the bloodiest battle in World War I. And so I think all that adds a depth to his life, from which these stories kind of come to life. The impact of his stories, I think, is how remarkably human they are, and the depth of human emotion and experience that they entail and incorporate.
Yeah. Would you say that the seriousness with which Tolkien treats big issues like death and love was influenced by the seriousness that he encountered those things within his life at an early age?
I would say so. And especially, you know, his parents dying at such a young age, especially his father, I'm not sure that he really reflected much on that loss, just because it wasn't a part of his memory. His mother's loss was something that definitely affected him. And I think he wrote more about the loss of his friends in World War I than he did the loss of his mother, at least what I've read. That's not to say there's not more. But he said that, you know, most of his school friends died in the war. He said in 1918, he said, by the end of the war, all but one of my closest friends were dead. Mm-hmm. And that those things, you just don't get over those things. I think anybody who's experienced loss and death like that, you never really get over them. And so it almost becomes a kind of continual fascination and kind of plumbing the depths of mysteries like death for meaning. How do we reckon with this? How do we go on living when we're surrounded by loss and death all the time, in one way or another? Not to be morbid, but just, you know, thinking truthfully about life.
And so how do you think his upbringing in the Catholic Church and being raised in that faith helped him to endure all of those losses? And what can we learn from that, you know, as we encounter loss in our everyday lives?
Yeah, he, for him, faith was definitely an anchor. And I think throughout his life, there were ways that he was able to tap back into that faith and his understandings of God and humanity in ways that kept him going, that kept him alive. I think certainly his relationship with his wife Edith was one that was a steadfast a relationship and an image of God's love to him as anything ever. And also his many friendships, which have been well noted with people like C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, he said that that there was a time in which, you know, he was struggling with his faith, and it was indeed it was Tolkien's friendship that led him into a place where he was able to accept God's love for himself, to enter into that. When Tolkien first met Lewis, he described him as the hardest boiled of all the atheists I've ever known. and to be a presence in someone's life like that, and to have them soften in a way that they are open to the love that God has for them, I think is just a powerful testimony to his own life and witness.
I always found his relationship with C.S. Lewis so fascinating, especially because of that line about him being, you know, that kind of tough shell to crack, and being so, I guess, devout in his atheism, if you can call it that. But, you know, for me, part of my call story is reading Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, and feeling that sort of explanation of who God is. And so for that to be directly related to what happened with Tolkien's faith encounter with C.S. Lewis, I think is really cool. You know, it doesn't, our witness of faith doesn't just end with us. There's a whole road, a ripple effect that follows.
Yeah. So I think that theme of fellowship, of friendship, comes out in the work of Tolkien very strongly. And I wonder if you have anything to say about the kind of societies and friendships that Tolkien cultivated in his life, and what that led him to be as a creator, as an artist.
Yeah. So Tolkien created, I guess you could call it, a vastly prodigious world in his stories. And it was something that was rooted in his expertise as a philologist, or someone who studies languages. And from an early age, he had been fascinated more with the structure and form and development of language than he was even with literature. And that's one of the things that he used to poke at C.S. Lewis about. They were both professors, C.S. Lewis of literature and he of linguistics. And he would, you know, poke at Lewis saying that, you know, literature is the art of 30 to 40 somethings with nothing else to do. You know? I think his expertise and his know-how in linguistics was really the impetus for what helped him to create his world and his art. And he also was someone who is in touch with art itself. There's an entire book, and I can't remember the title of it right now, that showcases Tolkien's art. He drew a lot of the places that he describes in his stories. So most editions of The Hobbit, you can pick up the drawings that are interspersed throughout some of the chapters are actually Tolkien's ink drawings of those scenes. And from an early age, she had been interested in both linguistics and in art. And I think that for him, in his own relationships with people like Lewis and the other writers who made up the group that they called the Inklings, who met regularly and would tease each other and drink beer and criticize one another's writings, I think that that kind of a group was as much a small group for him as, like, if we were to call something a small group today, that might be something that was a small group for him. To have that level of accountability and friendship, a safe space where he could go and take his art, take his quirkiness, his all his strange sensibilities and interests, and lay them on the table and have people both celebrate them and pick them apart and help him to be better. He said of that group that if it wasn't for them, he would have never finished Lord of the Rings.
That's an enduring reminder to us that artistry, creation never happens in isolation.
Absolutely.
We never think of something on our own. We're all the product of our friendships and our relationships, and that's especially present in the church. We are the product of the saints. We are the product of all our good close friends. I think that's a good reminder.
I think it's interesting, you know, when you think about as pastors, even for those of us who are pastors listening to this, you know, we write sermons every week, and after years and years of writing a sermon every week, you know, eventually you kind of get hung up a little bit, and it is by that conversation and that sort of creative accountability that we're able to learn new things out of scripture and come up with new things. And it's funny though, because most of it isn't our own creation. It's inspiration and the guidance from that sort of friendship.
Yeah, there's a great scene in the Tolkien biopic that just came out where he encounters his soon-to-be philology teacher, and he tells him, "Oh, I've created my own language." And his teacher had heard him out kind of narrating some of this of his own created language, and he says, "Oh, it sounded like there was a little bit of maybe Norwegian or something in it." And Tolkien said, "Yeah, I stole a lot of that." And his teacher says, "Oh, never stole. Languages never steal. They always borrow and like ring out these things, borrow and adapt." And so even, yeah, in the way that we narrate our stories, our Christian journey, our personal walk with God, and we take the common images, the archetypal things that people can relate to, and carry them down the road.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, we're all a product of someone having lived Christian faith faithfully before us. And yeah, I would 100% agree with that. This is Christian faith is not something that can be done in isolation. It's a life that can be lived only alongside of people who faithfully embody Jesus Christ to us. And I think that's a perfect image for what the Inklings were for Tolkien. I think what accountability or discipleship groups are for us who are doing ministry day to day. And I think it's vitally important. It's not something that you can't continue to practice faith well if you don't have that, both support and accountability. And that was for him what that was.
So I guess we want to talk about Tolkien's great work.
Yeah.
Really what his legacy is. During our lifetime, we've seen trilogies of movies come from both of his really seminal works. And so I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your experience with Lord of the Rings, especially, and kind of what that story means for us today and what it can teach us.
Yeah. So when I first read Lord of the Rings, I was overwhelmed by so many things that Tolkien was weaving into that main adventure that I developed this kind of, I guess you'd call it an insatiable curiosity for what he wrote, for what in the world he was getting at. Because there's references in the Lord of the Rings that are never really fleshed out. This remarkably deep history is underpinning this great adventure that's taken by Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin and Gandalf and all the rest of that fellowship. And so the depth of lore that was present in The Lord of the Rings, I think was something that sparked in me a desire to learn more. And for me, it was kind of like when you read a scripture passage, or you're reading a book of the Bible, maybe for the umpteenth time, and something strikes you in that text, and you say, "Wait a minute, I've never noticed that before. That nuance that's there, and there's something deep. It could be something realizing that, you know, something that Jesus said isn't something that is just out of nowhere. He's quoting Leviticus."
Yeah.
And so then we go back and read Leviticus, and we, you know, surprisingly enough, we find God in the pages of Leviticus. Not that reading The Lord of the Rings is equal to reading scripture, but the same kind of experience was there for me. And that, yeah, you know, reading it through, it's like, there's something else here to be, there's some depth here to be plumbed. And it's very layered, and it's going somewhere. And so for me, that story itself, with its sense of adventure, I remember the first time I read Lord of the Rings, in the very first book, when the four hobbits are walking through the Shire, and the Black Riders, the Nazgul, are kind of pursuing them. It was just this haunting feeling, the way he writes so vividly. I remember being like looking over my shoulder as I'm reading this, and that kind of vividness and color that he adds to his world is just so, it is just something that I became enamored with. And so I just kept reading and reading, and pretty soon I was finding myself going back and reading The Hobbit again. And after having read Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit suddenly had this greater depth, and then reading The Silmarillion, suddenly all that stuff in Lord of the Rings started to make sense. And so over his life, he layered these stories deeper and deeper and deeper.
It's a world building process in which the references amplify and enlighten one another.
Definitely.
I think one of the things I love about The Lord of the Rings is especially when you watch the first movie, everything starts so happy. You know, you're in this beautiful place in the Shire, and you understand completely why they would never want to leave, because it's just green and it's peaceful, and there's something nice about living in a little hole in the side of a hill that just, I don't know, it feels comfortable to me. That would be my ideal place to live. So when my husband and I first started dating, he would often be late for things, or at least in my opinion, late for things. And he would always quote from Lord of the Rings, "A wizard never arrives early nor late. He arrives precisely when he means to." Mm-hmm. And it drove me insane. But the more I watched The Lord of the Rings, the more I appreciated, especially when you have that line in the context of this party that's about to take place, and just the beauty and the peacefulness of the Shire. You know, we are always in a hurry for whatever reason, but sometimes we miss out on those opportunities to just be. And I think Gandalf is the king of just being a lot of times, mm-hmm. In The Lord of the Rings. So what can we learn just in that opening scene of Lord of the Rings, when we're preparing for this party? What can it teach us about our faith and our lives and how we live and just be every day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Shire, it is definitely a place that is pretty sequestered from what's going on around the in the world, in Middle Earth. And when we, you know, descend upon the opening of Lord of the Rings, we're hearing about Bilbo's 111st birthday, his 111th birthday, his life having been prolonged by having the ring in his possession for some time. And there's this general excitement in the air. The Shire is a place of, it seems, profound serenity. If you watch the movies, you see Frodo sitting under a tree reading a book. Bilbo is sitting at his desk composing his tale, The Hobbit, or There and Back Again. And everybody seems to be content to just go about their usual days doing what it is that they love, whether it's tending a garden or harvesting crops or paying attention to children playing. there's this beautiful scene where all the little hobbit children are chasing Gandalf in the wagon because they know he's come to bring fireworks. You know, Gandalf's bringing the party. And there's just something to be said about that, that peacefulness of being in community and people taking care of one another. And I think that's the context in which Frodo grows up. Frodo's parents were killed. They were drowned in a boating accident on the river. And Bilbo, who is actually Frodo's uncle, takes him in and raises him. And so there's this sense of community that's shared there. Yeah.
I think in my mind, the Shire, it represents this place of unlikely strength. And even Gandalf says that.
Right.
That when he's talking about the spread of power out of Isengard and Mordor, that they're these isolated places of people of all races, of Shire folk and elves and dwarves, that they'll need the power still of all of those different places, the remarkable courage. And in a lot of ways, The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit are both about the unlikely strength of the hobbit folk. And so what other kind of folk wisdom or tales do you think are contained in Lord of the Rings? Because I think one of the remarkable things about Tolkien's writing is he always drops these really powerful lines, and some of them are in our public memory. So not all who wander are lost. You want to give us the correct interpretation of this?
Sure. So that's kind of funny. You mentioned that. It's kind of a pet peeve of mine, because that's like a line that's taken out of context, and you see it on like wall decals, or somebody's got it on their sticker on their computer, or a bumper sticker. And really what it is, it's a line of a poem that Bilbo writes about Aragorn, who we know is, you know, descended from Isildur and is the true
ranger.
Heir. Yeah, he's a ranger from the north. He's a true heir to the thrones of Arnor and Gondor. And so he writes this poem. It says, "All that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king." And so it's a really interesting poem, because it's talking about how in this, so Aragorn, for example, who goes by Strider in the north, he seems kind of a wretched, old, hooded and cloaked ruffian from the wild.
Suspicious character.
Yeah, suspicious character. When Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin first meet him, they're ready to do battle. He's kind of sitting over in the corner in the prancing pony, looking suspicious. And it turns out that that Aragorn is again the heir to the thrones of Gondor and Arnor, and he is a very humble and unsuspecting kind of hero. And he shows that throughout the journey. Even he's tempted by the ring at one point, and pushes the ring back into Frodo's chest. He submitted himself to this great adventure, to this great quest, this great journey to destroy and upend evil. And he has this remarkable fidelity to his friends, but also to that mission, and it guides him. And it seems like in The Lord of the Rings, you find this great strength in unlikely people, be it a Samwise Gamgee, who over and over again, as the youngest of the hobbits, just shows himself to be of real quality. Aragorn, again, somebody who is very powerful, but would never attempt to wield that power in a way to coerce or force or harm those that he really cares about. And you see as well in this great adventure the coming together of what we would call different races of people, dwarves and elves and men.
Yeah, do you want to say something about the relationship between elves and dwarves?
Sure. So let's get really geeky for a minute. So
Just for a minute.
We haven't gotten there yet. So in the history of Middle Earth, there was really no ever true friendship between the dwarves and the elves, except for one moment during the Second Age, between the elves of this place called Eregion and the dwarves of Moria, which you'll remember the Mines of Moria is where the Fellowship passes through in Lord of the Rings.
Which is why the door is written in...
Yeah, in Elvish. That's right. Yeah. Speak friend and enter. So there was this... during this time in the Silmarillion, the friendship of elves and dwarves peaks, and also this great craftsmanship and skill is at its peak. And you have these two civilizations living in this real harmony and unity because of their craft. And it's at this time that Sauron comes back into play. At this point, Tolkien says that he's able to maintain a fair appearance, and he comes to them and begins to talk about how we need to heal the earth, Middle Earth, and how this is a time for us to rebuild what's been destroyed and to take these crafts and to use them for good. And so he teaches them how to create these rings. And so this is the elf Celebrimbor was the chief of the smiths, and he listened to Sauron intently. He was very intrigued by this craft, and so they began to make all these rings of power. And this is the time when Sauron then steals away to Mount Doom and creates the Ring of Power. And when he puts it on, the elves who had created the three rings for themselves are aware of him, mm-hmm. and they go into hiding and create. There's a series of wars between the dwarves and elves and Sauron, and he utterly just destroys them. And after that time, there were several instances where dwarves and elves offended one another, and they never really came back into unity. And so, for the sake of the Lord of the Rings, you have this moment at the Council of Elrond where all the free folk of Middle Earth representatives are gathered, and they're talking about what are we going to do with this ring of power that's been discovered, this one ring. And you have this coming together in fellowship of races of people that had been sundered by various things that had happened in history. And so you have this rivalry and this suspicion that exists between Legolas and Gimli. And they kind of become the microcosm of this animosity.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, they become kind of the heartbeat of the film adaptations, the real the real spirit of that.
Right, yeah, this kind of this great playfulness and rivalry that they share, and at first it is kind of a there is kind of a real sense of, you know, who's better here, who's greater, the elf or the dwarf, and as time goes on, they learn to really trust each other for their lives. Mm-hmm. And before long that rivalry becomes more playful, and you get the sense that they were really great friends. They make this pact after the Battle of Helm's Deep where Gimli promises to come and see the great woods where Legolas is from, and Legolas promises to go explore the deep caves behind Helm's Deep with Gimli.
Nice.
Yeah.
So we know that there is this sort of force of power and of evil that we see in the ring, this thing that we're working towards that brings them together, that is also the source of their trouble, but also the source of their mutuality. So the philosophy major in me has to bring up Ring of Gyges. And the Ring of Gyges was something that Plato referenced in The Republic, in Book 2 of The Republic. And the purpose of the Ring of Gyges was that it was something whoever held it would turn invisible. And it was sort of a moral dilemma. If you have the ring, it was a measure of your intelligence, not a measure of will or bravery or any of that. It was a measure of your intelligence if you could still maintain the fight against evil or the temptation to do wrong, even if you are invisible. And so I wonder if there's some influence there for Tolkien from the Ring of Gyges and that whole dilemma from Plato that causes us to ask, if we have ultimate power, do we still know how to be good people who fight against what is wrong, or who still fight for what is right? And so I don't know if there's an influence there for Tolkien from the Ring of Gyges, but what can we learn from that same sort of question if we put that question from Plato into what we hear in Lord of the Rings?
No, that's actually a great comparison. like, I can't say for certain that that influenced Tolkien, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me, as well read as he was, that that didn't play a role in how he understood things. He talks about the ring as being, it's being about power. He said that, you know, the Lord of the Rings, in a sense, and really his entire world, is dealing with things like fall and mortality and the machine. Mm-hmm. And by the machine, he means like machines of war and like the mechanization of the world, valuing things over people. And the ring, it plays this remarkable role in the history of Middle Earth from the point that we were just talking about earlier onward, because Sauron infuses his own life force into that ring. Mm-hmm. And so all of his malice, his cruelty, the evil that was implanted in him from Melkor, in the beginning of time, in the kind of primordial age, he pours that into the ring, because his whole point in creating it was to be able to coerce and dominate other creatures, that he would gift those rings that were made by the elves to them. And so he's he plants within that this deep temptation to power, and every being that possesses the ring at some point or another, uses it for their own gain. And there's this great moment in The Lord of the Rings where Frodo is afraid to take the ring for himself once Gandalf goes away. So like in the movie, Gandalf leaves the night of Bilbo's party and says, "Hey, I'll be back." And it looks like it's like 2 days later he's back. But in The Lord of the Rings, in the book, it's about 9 years that Gandalf goes away and Frodo continues to live in the Shire, and then he comes back. And there's this moment where, you know, Frodo finds out about what the ring really is, and he's like, you know, "Dude, take it. I can't do anything with this. Mm-hmm. You know, I have no business having something this powerful in my possession." And Gandalf says, "You know, no, like, you can't tempt me with this, because I would try to use it out of a desire to do good.
Right.
But through me, it would wield this power that's too great and terrible to name."
Right.
And I think about, in our own Christian faith, how sin works in our lives, and that kind of corruption. Like, you know, there's that saying, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions." Uh-huh. And I think the ring is kind of it is an image of that. Like, we would, were we given the choice of downward mobility, like we see with Jesus submitting to death and to the powers to reveal God's love, versus, you know, wielding something, a sword like Peter in the garden, or, you know, like the zealots wanting to take, you know, take up arms against Rome. Like, we would choose the ring every time out of a desire to bring about good in the way that we would name good. Mm-hmm. But that power would eventually destroy us.
Yeah. And I think that's a testament to why Frodo so much needs Sam, and mm-hmm. and honestly, why Frodo so much needs the creature Gollum, mm-hmm. because bearing the weight of the ring to put it into it is not a solitary exercise either.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, do you want to say anything about the end of the ring?
Sure. You know, there's this great scene where when they're in Moria. And Gandalf, or Frodo's kind of lamenting that he has the ring and he has to do this. And Gandalf reminds him that, you know, we can't control what falls into our lap, what suffering comes our way. We just have to figure out how best to, I mean, I'm totally paraphrasing, but how to, we got to figure out what to do with the time that's given us, mm-hmm. you know, to figure this out. And later on, you know, Galadriel reminds him that to be a bearer of a ring, because she has one of the three elven rings, to be a ring bearer is to be alone. And in a sense, there is a sense that only Frodo can do this. The ring has, in a sense, chosen him, and he's the only one who can bring it to where it needs to go. But on the other hand, the story plays out a little bit differently, like you said, Aaron, that, you know, there's Sam all along the way for him, reminding Frodo who he is when the ring starts to take possession of him and to change him. And there's Gollum, who comes back into the story. Bilbo spared him a long time ago when he had an opportunity to kill him. And Gollum ends up playing a really important role in The Lord of the Rings, in that he becomes kind of the unexpected, unsavory guide to Frodo and Sam. Mm-hmm. At first, Gollum doesn't understand why they need to go to Mordor, but all he knows is that Frodo has his precious, and he's going to do what he can to get it back, even if that means going along with them for a while. And there's this deep sense that you see in the story, both in the book and the movie, where Gollum and Frodo share this kind of kinship that no one else really knows, mm-hmm. because both of them have borne the ring and are bearing it in a time when it's probably most perilous to do so. And so there's this remarkable tension in Frodo and Gollum's relationship, in that they have shared this incredible burden, and yet they are so very tempted by its power. And at the end of The Lord of the Rings, when they're climbing Mount Doom, after having thought that Sam had gotten rid of Gollum, he comes back, and he's more dangerous than he'd ever been. Mm-hmm. It seems like
the closer you get to
The closer you get to the end, the closer you get to its destruction, the more sinister it is. It's like when you back a rabid dog into a corner. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you think that dog's going to do? It's going to come out, or a person, they're going to come out swinging. And it seems like the ring's power is greatest in the place where it's created and can also be destroyed. And that this at the ending, Frodo puts on the ring. The place where the ring is most tempting, Frodo for a moment succumbs to it, puts the ring on. Gollum leaps on him, bites his finger off, and yells, "Precious, precious!" And then he missteps and he's gone. And the ring ends up being unmade in the place where it was created. It was only like the fires in which it was created is the only place where it can be destroyed. And so it's really this this interesting kind of mark that's left behind. Frodo, Bilbo, the remaining ring bearers, they can't stay in the world anymore. They've been scarred permanently by it.
Yeah. I think it's important to mention what the ring says in the inscription, because its entire inscription is lived out throughout the story. So one ring to rule them all, one ring to find them, one ring to bring them all, and in the darkness bind them. And so you sort of see it's almost its own narrative written into the ring. But also this beauty and how it has this way of reminding us of our loneliness and our isolation in some ways, and how we can be brought together in that, even if it's a weird thing that is causing us to be bound in that. And so I wonder how it translates into our everyday lives, not just for those of us who are clergy, but for those of us who are lay folk. How do we see the ways in which we can put down our differences to fight for what's good in the world? Because this is an unlikely group of people that comes together.
Absolutely it is. It's a story that brings together very unlikely people. If you'll allow me for a minute, I can run down a little bit of each of the people in the Fellowship. So you have, of course, Strider Aragorn. Again, we talked about him earlier. He's a ranger, but really the true heir to the thrones, a very humble, loyal, high-born human. Then you have Boromir, who is the son of Denethor, who's the steward, the caretaker of the throne for the kingdom of Gondor, who is very, we might call him brutish. He thinks a little more with his muscles than he does with his brain, but he's sturdy, stalwart, and
always blows the horn of Gondor before he goes out on a journey.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. He's kind of like he's the firstborn, the heir, and he knows it. But he's also a fierce warrior and protector of his friends. And then, of course, you have Legolas, who is a prince. He's been alive for thousands of years. He's seen a lot of things himself, but still fairly young in elven terms. But is someone who has this incredible gift for sight and being able to see great distances, both literally and figuratively. Some of the the deeper wonders of the elves. And then of course you have Gimli, who's not all overhead smart, but is a pretty practical thinker and a very proud person as a dwarf. Very sturdy, very hardy, very quick on the decision making, even if it's not the correct decision, and extremely stubborn. Hard to get along with. And then, of course, you have the hobbits. You have Pippin, who's the youngest, who's very...
Fool of a Took.
Yeah, he's a fool. Fool of a Took. Very impulsive, very foolish. Merry, you know, he's a bit older, and he's probably the most stable of the four hobbits, mm-hmm. as far as their journey goes. He's not that he doesn't change, but that he just seems to be the most even keel throughout the story. And then Sam, who's very young, inexperienced, not wise to the world, but so faithful and so true a friend that virtue alone tends to carry him through some pretty precarious situations. And then there's Frodo, who is not he's actually in his 50s in the Lord of, in the book, so he's not a young guy, but he is the great front man of the story. And and then of course there's Gandalf, who is not human, though he appears human. He's actually mm-hmm. kind of he's what they call one of the Maiar, which is kind of like a demigod mm. in a sense. And he's been sent to Middle Earth to help the free peoples fight against Sauron and evil. And so you have all these guys with these strange and varied stories coming together in this quest. And when they're set off on this quest, they're not obligated to stay and to help for any longer than they feel yeah. they can.
Elrond says yeah. that there's no oath which you take.
That's
that
right.
You can yeah. you can leave.
Right.
And I think the surprising beauty of this story is you have all these rather estranged peoples. We're at a time and place in the world where people have become suspicious of one another, and we've kind of circled our wagons and are protecting our own. But these folks come together, and they do something rather remarkable that really no other combination of folks could have pulled off in their quest. And all of them stay. All of them stay at the table until the bitter end, even though along the way their paths diverge. Frodo and Sam are off this way. Merry and Pippin get captured. They get off this way. Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas go off this way. Boromir dies, of course, and Gandalf dies. And sorry, spoiler alert. But even though their paths diverge, they all end up in the same place at the end. They stay together.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important for us to understand as Christians in a world, in a denomination, where there are folks who think differently, who have experienced the world differently, who come from varied stories that not everyone is able to understand, and we stay at the table with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And find courage in one another. Saruman kind of gets on Gandalf, and so do other members of his order, for his odd obsession with the little folk.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, they wonder why Gandalf, why are you hanging out with hobbits and all kinds of interesting creatures? And it's because Gandalf has this great insight into the common courage mm-hmm. of regular mm-hmm. people, and kind of how that can rise to the occasion of great turmoil and division. Well put, during our divisive time.
Definitely. Yeah. There's this, speaking of that, there's, you know, people often criticize the movies because they change so much from the books, or they put things in there that weren't said by characters. But there's this great scene in The Hobbit, where Galadriel is speaking with Gandalf, and she's like, "Why the Hobbit, Gandalf? Why him, Bilbo?" And he says, "You know, I found that, you know, I found wisdom in the world, and that, you know, Saruman seems to think that it's great power that holds evil in check, but I found it's really the little everyday things that ordinary people do that keeps the evil at bay." And he says, you know, why Bilbo Baggins? Perhaps it's because I'm afraid and he gives me courage. Mm-hmm. It's a great line, even though it's not from the book. It's just a really great line. Great interpretation of what Tolkien, I think, was getting at in these ideas of adventure and togetherness.
Well, I think that a lot of people in the maybe environmental community, in mm-hmm. the kind of creation care community, have a special place in their heart for Tolkien and The Lord of the Rings. And I wonder what you could say about how the work deals with Earth and the ages of Earth and generally the care for creatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so from the very beginning, one thing that Tolkien does that's so unique is that he... in the Silmarillion, he actually has like a creation myth, and he has these very deep stories about how his world was formed. And you know, he comments, he says, you know, this is myth. I mean, it's kind of this great storytelling that he said it may be hard for people who believe in the Blessed Trinity to read this creation narrative with all these great kind of godlike powers at work in creating something. But he, you know, again, it's his reminder that, you know, he's not trying to rewrite the creation stories of Scripture or imitate them. He's creating his own world. But the way he tells the story of creation, it's music. You know, there is the one, Iluvatar, and he is God, and he begins to sing this melody, and he creates these powers called the Valar, and they each have their own notes and music to add. And so for Tolkien, his creation myth is symphony. It's mm-hmm. about all these voices singing together. And there's this one Valar named Melkor who starts to sing dissonance and discord into things. And you know, it's kind of how corruption and evil enter the world. But all of the Valar with Iluvatar are interested in creating, and each of them has their own kind of expertise or thing that they're linked to. So Yavanna is one of these, and she's interested in creating, growing things in the world, and establishing the trees and the flowers and the growth and animals and things like that. And so there's this, from the very beginning in his storytelling, there's this deep connection between the ethereal, the divine, and the created world, mm-hmm. and how the Valar are continue, and the Maiar and these other kind of divine beings that he talks about are intensely linked to something in creation, and they're profoundly interested in its fate.
Concerned with the people there. What can you say about the creatures of the Ents?
Oh yeah, so they're very peculiar, and I'd probably have to go back to and read a little bit more. They're only scantily referenced in the Silmarillion, but Treebeard's conversations with Merry and Pippin are very interesting, and he talks about how he, you know, it was the elves that woke them up and taught them mm-hmm. How to speak, and they've been around for much longer even than the elves. But it was through the Ents that the elves kind of maintained this deep connection to the earth. And that's the Ents kind of, it's almost like they serve as kind of this crossover species. There's Ents and there's Hjorns, which are kind of more tree-like than Ent-like, but they are these beings that in The Lord of the Rings at least serve a purpose to remind people like Sauron, who gets so caught up in the machinations of war, mm-hmm. That there is an earth here. There's something at stake here. Creation's at stake, and the evil that you're causing, you're scarring and destroying the earth. You know, the elves themselves have a deep connectedness to the land.
Yeah, and to creatures. I mean, when you see the hobbits show up in the elvish territory, well, they come away and their beloved pony Bill has like this special knowledge.
There's just all this, and you know, think about like Radagast, who's a wizard, like Gandalf. He ends up in his pursuit of trying to help the creatures of the peoples of Middle Earth hold back evil. He ends up becoming really obsessed with animals. Mm-hmm. He spends most of his time with creatures in the woods, and that becomes, in a sense, his mission is to help creatures who are less than kind of sentient beings thrive and continue to exist, that they too are part of what needs to be protected. Even though what they were sent there for was for the, you know, the dwarves and the elves and the men, it's also about creatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and there's something, you know, for us as Christians, when we think about our responsibility to the earth God has given us, it's, you know, what we see from Lord of the Rings. It's more than just a, you know, a care for the earth, caring about the earth, more than, you know, getting rid of plastic straws, but it's a connectedness to, mm-hmm. to the earth and to creation, and to listening to what creation has to say to us. And so a real beauty in that lesson, and how we too can take our power and our authority and our ability to listen, and turn that into ways to care for the earth that God has, mm-hmm. has given us. So,
well said, Laura.
Thank you.
Before we end on a serious note, I'm going to have to ask Patrick if he can do a voice for us. Maybe you can give us some kind of blessing in the voice of Smeagol.
Oh, a Smeagol benediction, if yeah. you will.
A Smeagol benediction.
Final word of Smeagol benediction.
All right, let's see if I can work it up. I may have to do this multiple times. Okay, let's see if I can work this up.
May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift his face to you and give you peace, my precious.
That was great.
That was beautiful.